Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is March 20th, 2025, and this is episode 510. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, and I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in the heel of Italy. How you doing, John? Any more earthquakes?
I didn't even hear about the first earthquake, really. Yeah. So it must have been kind of a big shrug for everybody around here.
Good. So today we're going to get to a long-promised subject, which is the British naval mutiny at the end of the 18th century that John had talked about a few episodes back, and a few subscribers gave us the old LFG. So, John, let's fucking go on the mutiny.
Okay. The mutiny is a big story that doesn't get covered very much. And when it does get covered, it's sort of in the world of British military buffs. And it doesn't seem to interest non-British people very much, which is a shame because, I know there are a lot of people who study, for example, Kronstadt and the Kronstadt mutiny very carefully, but that was a little ripple compared to the wave of the British mutinies, which actually started in 1797 and continued into 1798. These were stunning events, and they really did stun the contemporary world because the British fleet was the heart of British power. And in fact, you can see when you step back that the British fleet was what sustained Britain during the Napoleonic Wars, which had already begun, even though Napoleon wasn't at his most prominent point here. The war between Britain and France, anyway, revolutionary France, had begun years before, and there was no chance, it emerged pretty quickly, of dealing with the French Revolutionary Army on land, like attempting to invade France, because they were just kicking ass all over Europe. But Britain had the fleet, and France had a centuries-long history of underestimating the value of sea power. And Britain wasn't able to survive, just to give a bit of a spoiler alert, through the fleet. And when the wars ended in 1815, the fleet suddenly was the major power in the world. And you can understand the British domination of the 19th century much more easily if you see that they were really the one naval power that emerged from those Napoleonic Wars completely intact. I mean, there were other naval powers, but they were small countries, and they were generally content to let the British do most of the colonizing and, as they would say in D.C., heavy lifting. But there was a moment, the moment we're going to talk about, where that was all on a knife edge, because in 1797, against all expectation, the heart of British defense, the nation's one reliable military arm, the fleet, revolted. I mean, I really am amazed at how little attention this gets. I mean, to some extent, it's because this is a military history matter that we leave to British military pedants who are fiercely patriotic, unlike French military pedants who seem to want to live down any connection with patriotism or military or Franco superiority. The British have no such allergies, and they're very much in favor of this. So they don't really want to talk about this. It was not one of their better moments because the fleet, which could absolutely destroy any other European fleet, and they're, aside from the U.S., which is a separate category, there were no other fleets that were in the running. Aside from that, the fleet had no enemies, really. It was an apex predator, as it would show once the Napoleonic threat was over. And suddenly, there was like a cancer at the heart of the fleet. That is the two mutinies, the Spithead and the Nore. We'll get to what those are a little later. But the two big fleets that were going to have to intervene in Europe and patrol European shores to maintain the boycott of Napoleonic Europe suddenly refused to fight anymore and were very close to sailing their ships into French ports. And there were two mutinies, the Spithead Mutiny and the Nore Mutiny. The Spithead Mutiny quickly assumed the characteristics of an industrial dispute, as many British historians try to call it. It was not exactly that. It was a little more influenced by developments within France and the United States and the general disgust for the reign of the Georgian kings in England because they seem to live forever and do nothing, just opposing everything that might improve the country.
They made for good characters in Blackadder, is about
how they did. They did.
Yeah.
I mean, Blackadder is an extraordinary series in some ways. I mean, they destroy certain deeply held shibboleths of the British orthodoxy, like there's an episode in the World War I episode Blackadder where they say, oh, come on, German inroads in our colonies, they have about 2 acres of Africa that you gave them. and then there's one that really astounded me in the Elizabethan Blackadder where the Puritan aunt visits him and says, wicked boy, after he complains of the cold, wicked boy, cold is God's way of telling us to burn more Catholics. And that's an astounding mention in British history. And I think the naval mutinies of 1797, 1798 have sort of been memory-holed in a similar way. Mm. You would think, they would be great examples for the more radical socialist wing of the British left, but I haven't seen that. In fact, my latest book that I've read and relied on to some extent for this episode is by a pretty standard naval history fan, Philip McDougall, and his book is called The Naval Mutinies of 1798, and then it has a colon, The Irish Plot to Seize the Channel Fleet. Now that's where we get into some doubtful territory. And in this
that's
case,
a little weird.
The
something, the Jewish plot to seize something,
Oh, well, that is still a very strong current in English historiography, including some very eminent leftist historians that we will forbear to mention. But I've read other accounts of this mutiny that really did not stress the Irish component nearly as much. I mean, there was one that was popular about 10 years ago that I can't really remember the name of, but it really stressed the daily horror of being in the Royal Navy. And that rang perfectly true. And I think it would have given anybody plenty of reason to revolt. I mean, it's right to revolt may be a slogan now, but it was very, very right to revolt if you had to serve on a ship. There are other conditions that involved the degree of misery and the degree of rage among these crews. First of all, many of them were not there because they, quote, volunteered. In fact, what's volunteering? If you're going to starve, starving was a real possibility for poor English, let alone Irish or Scottish people. You might as well volunteer for the Navy because somebody would feed you something. This was a very different world from the one we think of as normal. The populations of Britain and Ireland, for example, were not at all skewed the way they are now. Ireland never recovered from the artificial famine it suffered in the middle of the 19th century. Well, it suffered, or it was imposed upon, I mean, like the Flann O'Brien.
The forced starvation, you know?
Yeah, the forced starvation, yeah. There's a Flann O'Brien line, I broke my leg, or rather I had it broken for me. Right. And that kind of applies to the sudden devastating population drop in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century when every other European population was zooming ahead in population. So it is plausible, in line with this recent book by McDougall, that England would have been frightened of an Irish component to these naval revolts. In fact, they tended to blame almost everything.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to reiterate, yeah, but the estimates are rough, although there was an actual census in 1801, but the estimate is roughly 5 million in Ireland and, at least in England itself, roughly 8 million. Whereas today, Ireland's population is 5 million. And at least
versus 60 odd.
Yeah. It says something about how genocide works.
They had a strange lingering effect after the famine, too. The land ownership became very important. The Irish family size, which had been the biggest in Western Europe, I think, suddenly shrank. The age of marriage went from something like 19 to something like 40. A radically different country.
So
that's one thing to keep in mind. So there probably was a real fear of the Irish. The other thing is, and it's connected to that, the ships tended to be stuffed with people who either had no other economic option and joined the Navy because they could at least get a few meals, though those meals were not that great. And they would keep body and soul together. They may have had to live in a stinking cargo shed, basically, on the water, but at least they would be out of the rain. So the very poor joined the Royal Navy. A small class of able-bodied seamen joined the Navy. And many people who were convicted of crimes and given the option of prison or hanging or joining the Navy were also in the ranks. Then there's a fourth class, the people who were put in the Navy by getting in some way coerced by press gangs in naval towns, because there have been a lot of exaggerations about this, but there definitely were press gangs, and they definitely grabbed people, much as we've seen the Ukrainian army grab people off the streets.
Yeah.
And they needed everybody they could get at this point, because one thing about naval warfare is that it's at this point, roughly at the end of the 18th century, it's very labor intensive. So that if you wanted to have a frigate, like a mid-sized armed naval ship, you needed 300 crew. You didn't need that many to do the sails and scrub the deck. But if you needed them, if you were in combat, you needed a lot of crews. I mean, every cannon had to be served by a half dozen people.
Right.
And they were going to expect casualties too. So a lot of these people were just lying around. There's also the factor that in the later part of the 18th century, the Royal Navy was in some ways innovative, not in any way that would make the crew more comfortable, really, but in certain ways that made the ships able to stay at sea far longer. For example, they used to have to come in on shore to get the hull scraped. Otherwise, the shipworms would just bore right through them. But they discovered that copper was poisonous to these marine worms. And if you sheathed the hull in copper, you could stay out to sea for years, literally years, which was great news for the higher officers,
yes.
But really bad news for the people who were in those stinking holds.
Sea worms were the average Navy grunt's best friend. I mean, my God.
At least those leaves to scrape the hull of parasites gave you some time on shore. That was ended once they copper-bottomed the ships of the Royal Navy. The other abiding problems were discipline and the food. I mean, the food was just god-awful by all accounts. There are some attempts in a revisionist way to say, no, it wasn't that bad, or it wasn't that bad compared to what the average beggar picked up in the gutters. And, at that point, it becomes kind of a silly comparison. The food was unrelentingly sea biscuit and the kind of beef that was preserved in salt, but, and I don't fully understand this, I don't fully understand how this was done, but preserved in salt, but not often in vats of salt water. You see pictures, drawings, and paintings of naval cooks often with mallets and chisels, chopping out bits of salt beef from gigantic blocks of it. So they had a way of preserving it in salt, which by all accounts made it completely nauseating and stinking, but could keep it more or less fit for semi-human consumption for some time. And you mixed all these together with any vegetables, if you had them, but they often did not have them. And when they did have them, they were desiccated in a primitive way and not particularly appetizing. So it was a grim life. I mean, I know there have been attempts to revise it, often by historians closely linked to the patriotic tradition in Britain, which is itself closely linked to the naval tradition. But I remember a recent article that I actually put on Facebook because it was by a writer who had done a voyage replicating Darwin's voyage around the world, or at least his voyage from Britain to Australia. And he was very gung-ho about it. And he said, I loved it. It was like a vacation. And it's like, well, you ever think maybe it wasn't quite like serving in the Royal Navy circa 1790? But he just said he loved it. He was great. Anyway, I suspect things were a little rougher in 1790. And they were rougher for the underclass in particular because they had to deal with naval officers who were often a very scary bunch of people, very weird. The younger sons of the gentry who often had a point to prove about themselves or had once maybe been halfway decent officers and had spent a little too much time out at sea and had gone weird in some way or other. So I thought as a way of illustrating the motivations for the mutiny, I would read this bio of, or rather summarize this bio of a naval veteran of Britain. He was, first of all, he was Irish. He was, and that was very typical. The Irish population was not only almost half that of England, but they were also vastly poorer than the average person in Britain, and therefore more likely to join up or be dragooned into the Navy. So this guy's name is David O'Brien Casey.
Also, I would imagine probably not a lot of ways for somebody who's Irish, from the Irish underclass to, I don't know, to get ahead may not be quite the right way to put it, but to get ahead, you know, in the English
Absolutely.
Empire.
Yeah.
And this is true in a lot of cultures, but the military, if you have that chance, is one way to, I don't know, maybe get ahead and crawl out of your ghetto.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it happens in America too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The career of Casey was very typical of this way. Like, you know, maybe you die, but if you don't die, maybe you get promoted. And
right.
at least you're promoted into something like the lower middle class. And that's almost a dream.
Yeah.
For a lot of these people, because you have to remember, after the 18th century or during the course of the 18th century, Irish industries were pretty much exterminated, except for Belfast, which got separate treatment. But they were considered to be competitors with English industry. And they were not wanted. Ireland was wanted as a source of cheap, desperate labor and of farm supplies. They did not want Irish textile industry, for example, and they wiped it out pretty thoroughly. The Irish penal laws, the laws that govern what Irish Catholics, and to some extent this involves only Irish Catholics, to some extent it involved everyone who was in Ireland, including the large Protestant population, that they were forbidden to engage in all kinds of business and forbidden to engage in all kinds of conduct, like all those colorful Irish traditions like the shillelagh were the results of the fact that Irish Catholics were forbidden to carry weapons. And so all they could do is like, suppose I just carry a walking stick and pour a little lead into the head of it. I mean, that would make a nice weapon. But if a cop stops you, you could say it's just a walking stick. The Zulu, actually, in the British administration, carried umbrellas in very much the same way. And you would apparently see Zulu men walking around with furled umbrellas, and it would be like no clouds in the sky and 100 degrees. And it's like, how come you got this umbrella? It's like, none of your business. There's a lot of innovation like that, but it's basically because your life is trammeled and restricted in a million different ways. David O'Brien Casey is born in that tradition. He enters the Navy in a very important year, the year the French Revolution begins, 1789. He's a captain's servant in the 24-gun ship Hyena. And
great name for a ship, by the way.
Yeah.
Props for that.
the heroes of the sea. They quickly get involved in the Franco-Anglo War when the French capture his ship in the Caribbean. They come upon a French 40-gun ship, and they're outgunned. And this is one of those British naval losses you never hear about. Like this guy who wrote the article about what a jolly time he had going on a replica voyage to Australia said, after all, the Royal Navy never lost a battle. And no, they lost a lot of battles, but they won more often than they lost. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They were a formidable force, but they lost a lot of battles. I mean, that's how they lost in Cornwallis's expedition in the southern U.S. I mean, there was a fight between a French fleet and a British fleet to see whether anyone would relieve Cornwallis, and the French fleet won, and Cornwallis had to surrender. That tends to get memory-holed as well. But anyway, so he's then a prisoner with the entire crew at what was then Saint-Domingue, later to become Haiti and Dominican Republic when it revolted against the French and provided a real example of revolutionary ardor for most of Europe. In 1793, he gets involved in that fighting, and his uncle is killed. So he makes his way to Jamaica, which is an English possession, and he joins the Hermione. I never know how to pronounce that from, you know, I think a generation of people after me grew up knowing how to pronounce it from Harry Potter. But I think it's Hermione. The Hermione is not one of those happy ships like this replica sailor sailed on. This was one of those real ships with a lunatic for a captain and no hygienic practices. The Hermione lost half its crew to disease in 4 months in the West Indies. And it's not clear how that happened, because certainly there were a lot of mosquito-borne diseases and water-borne diseases in a tropical environment, which could easily kill you. But it could also be that the ship wasn't handled very well. So the remains of the crew, they didn't have the people to crew it anymore. So he transferred to a ship called the Swift Shore. The Swift Shore accompanied another schooner which had wine to unload at Cape Nicola Mole, which was on the north shore of Haiti. They missed the harbor and hit the rocks, and only two men survived. Naval shipwrecks were pretty lethal things. You generally didn't survive. A lot of sailors didn't know how to swim, and the shark populations had not nearly been reduced to current levels. So two men survived. He was one of them. So already, you know, he's like been winnowed out.
It's amazing.
Of this Darwinian process that killed a lot of other people in the same intake he was. So he got an appointment as a sort of officer, because by this point, you know, the British Navy is running very short of people under a Captain Tasden, who he notes as a very strict and severe officer.
So if you're noted as a strict and severe officer in the British Navy, Yeah, you're
you're a raving lunatic.
Yeah,
yes.
You're to the right of like Himmler or something. Like, yeah.
Yep. The ship becomes entangled in a coral reef, and Casey is the man on duty at the time, watching the ship to keep it out of danger. And for that, he's court-martialed for negligence, and more importantly, for disagreeing with his captain when he tried to justify himself. Like, I had nothing to do with this. God knows what he told him, but like, anyway, you didn't disagree with the captain. There was a tradition that the captain is authority as long as you're at sea. Your captain has authority over life and death. When he's court-martialed, he gets transferred to another ship. This was now under the command of another bad captain. There were a lot of bad captains. And this guy is named Hugh Pigott.
God, yeah, that's like, yeah, that's like something from, I don't know, Dickens or Waugh or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hugh Pigott. and I'll just read from the description here. Pigott was a cruel officer who meted out severe and arbitrary punishments to his crew and developed the practice of flogging the last sailor down from working the sails. And they became so terrified of being the last one to come down out of the rigging that three sailors, in their haste to get down from the rigging, jumped down onto the deck, and one of them hit and injured one of the masters, Southcott, because he landed on him. I mean, they were willing to risk their lives and their legs to land on the deck sooner than the other two, because the last man was going to be flogged. It seems sort of like a PE times 1,000. Forever and ever.
They died, though, you write here, that three of these sailors died, and including one of them that hit Southcott.
Or they were dying, and he threw them overboard anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, he ordered them, quote, throw the lubbers overboard. So in a nine-month period, Captain Pigott ordered 85 floggings. That is half the crew. At least two of the men who were flogged died from their injuries. So that's something of the ardor that drove people crazy. I mean, I know that there's a fad in current British historiography. I think there have been many, many other such fads to say it wasn't that bad. I kind of think they're lying.
It sounds like one of the really, one of the worst types of slave plantations in the South. Like, there were different types of slave riders, or different masters at varying degrees of cruelty. And this guy in particular sounds like he's more on the very cruel end. But it's very similar in a way. Like,
yeah,
very punitive. But,
his other captain was known, Captain Twisden was known as, quote, a very strict and severe officer.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of them. I mean,
there wasn't a whole lot of, variation there. There was one guy who's a very strict and severe officer, and another guy is, wait, what's this? Another strict and severe officer.
Like, yeah.
Thanks for the big menu.
The odds were bad.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, in Cook's defense, and, Cook sometimes gets made into a villain because he contacted a lot of Aboriginal peoples, but he himself did not behave badly in those encounters. And he was known both for his relatively low birth and for his humanity towards his crew. Mm. And, in his voyage around the world, Cook lost one man.
Wow.
I mean, that's extraordinary. And I somehow wanted to say something for Cook because, you know, Cook was a good man to the extent that you could be serving a very rough empire. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of good reasons to be a little disgruntled with the Royal Navy and the terms of service in it. There are many other things going on. I mean, the world is changing very rapidly in the 1790s. There is the echo of the United States Revolution, which included a lot of French Enlightenment intellectual baggage that made its way into the English-speaking elite through propagandists like Thomas Paine.
Right, Thomas Paine.
And the sailors seem to have been a relatively literate lot. They may not have had any money or any rights, but they were fairly literate. And even if they weren't, you can find somebody to read things to you.
I mean, they're all together, you know, and all you need are a few literate people to educate the. And what are you going to do all day when you're not getting beaten or running up the sail and down the sail? It's,
So I'll just do a little footnote about what happened to the Hermione. Almost at the same time that the big mutinies in the fleets back in England occurred. That is 20th September 1797. The crew of the Hermione revolted against their captain, Pigott.
Wait, just to repeat here. So David O'Brien Casey, the figure we're following here, is back on the Hermione. Right? When this happens with Captain Hugh Pigott. Okay,
Okay. It was the bloodiest mutiny in British naval history. Captain Hugh Pigott was in command. And basically they said, the first thing we do is go in and kill the captain and the officers. And they did. They actually broke into his cabin, killed the guard, and hacked him up and threw him out into the sea while still living, which I have to admit, I've been watching a lot of shark videos, and it's like, please kill me on deck.
Yes,
I don't care who gets my carcass, but I would prefer to be dead at the time. Yeah. So Pigott and most of the officers were killed. The mutineers handed the ship over to the Spanish. The bitter irony here is that the Spanish were intensely monarchist, and they were appalled that these people had been hearing French revolutionary ideas and daring to overthrow their own captain. So they barely tolerated these people. They set them free with a few shillings and said, get out of here. Now, the composition of the crew is interesting on this particular ship. About half of the crew had been born in England and about a fifth in Ireland. The remaining sailors were from Germany, Norway, America, Canada, and Portugal. Two of them were of African descent. At least 20 were Americans. A slight majority appear to be Americans, and maybe because they got bonuses for enlisting. There were quite a number of them who had just been pressed into service. I mean, either hit on the head or just dragged aboard by a big party that just wanted bodies. They seem to have felt that, you know, you could learn whatever you needed to learn to be in the Royal Navy. And if you didn't, they'd beat you until you learned it. There the mutiny was extraordinary in its brutality, but that was because Pickett was a fairly extraordinary captain. But it's important to remember that only about half of the crew was English. The others, a fifth, were Irish. And by this time, I don't know, as I said, whether the Irish thesis that MacDougall uses is really correct. I think it might be a bit exaggerated. But the Irish population had been living under the penal laws for a century. And they were raised in hedge schools, if they got schooling at all. And a hedge school was where Catholics who were forbidden to be educated tried to organize an education. And it was usually priests who did this. And they the priests were subject to execution, if found, at least in the 18th century. And there was no love lost for the empire. It was not really trying to be nicey-nice
no.
the way it did later on.
What were the penal laws?
The penal laws were a set of quite punitive laws meant to coerce or suborn the Irish population into abandoning Catholicism. They were directed at people who adhered to Catholicism because that really was an ethnic divider at the time. And they meant that you could not enter certain professions, you could not carry weapons, you could not own land, in fact. So that at the end of the 18th century, only about 7% of the land in Ireland was under Irish ownership. They were very effective, they were very cruel, but most of all, they were intended to prevent the spread of literacy in a population. And to their credit, the Irish peasantry had access to this body of literate men, the priests, who circulated among them secretly and taught their children in hedge schools, meaning in the shadow of the hedges. Although I personally kind of doubt with an Irish climate you could teach school in a hedge. I would personally much rather be inside when I tried to learn the alphabet and such. So I think they used, you know, ordinary sheds or cabins or hovels, as was prevailing, rather than...
I just have to say, I mean, for people wondering why Ireland among Western European countries is supportive of Palestine and can understand what people in Gaza are going through, not just from, you know, from having read a book in college or something, but from deep history. It's just, the more you know about Irish history, the clearer it is. But, and another thing I would say, this for future episodes, but I mean, it seems pretty damn clear that the stories you tell, that Ireland was the laboratory for the British Empire to be, you know, exported elsewhere in the British Empire as they expanded. Like,
absolutely. But, you know, it was also the laboratory for theories of resistance. And a lot of the, I mean, during the 18th century, for example, Ireland was an overwhelmingly rural country, and the peasantry, which had been stripped of all its land, retaliated largely by burning haystacks and laming and just killing cattle in the fields that now belonged to their foreign overlords. There were other strategies, for example, to protect people who were being evicted from their property, such that, you know, you would just make it known that anyone who bought this property was likely to regret it.
It's I was going to say, it's a little bit like people setting fire to Tesla supercharging stations and stuff, but on a, yeah. a much more serious and scale with a lot more serious consequences and everything. But yeah. But, you know, in a minor way.
Oh, I'm sure they'd have set fire to Tesla stations if they'd had any. There might have been other ways to make a profit from them. But one of the results of this, and this is in support of McDougall's Irish theory about the fleet mutinies, which I don't fully hold to, I have to say is that they developed a certain expertise in guerrilla movements, either from membership in the Defenders or just if you know as a neighborhood tradition, oh yeah, we have the Defenders, you know, they go out and they lame the landlord's cattle. And maybe we could do something like that on board this ship, you know, because there were reports during the mutinies on the Nore, which was the more radical of the two mutinies, that the Irish contingent among the crews did function as an ad hoc guerrilla force, that one of them is reported to have said, if I give the word, I can have 25 men to back me, and we will tear apart anyone who informs or snitches on it. It kind of reminds me of that bit in Solzhenitsyn where he describes the maddening passivity of the Russian intellectuals in the camps who let the Vorovskonya rob them and all that. But then the Ukrainian rebels came in and they had no objection to using knives. It was like, okay, you got a knife, I got a knife. Let's see who wins. So that did pay off, you know, in a really practical way for the mutinies that were shortly going to begin. It also, though, raised certain ethnic tensions, which were partly to blame for destroying the mutinies. And we'll take a break here and come back.
Okay, we're back. John, why don't you pick it up where you left off?
So we're getting to the point at which the giant naval mutinies in the Spithead anchorage and the Nore really begin to explode. All the stage has been set. Above all, the British Empire has made a fatal mistake, which is by impoverishing this very large ethnic minority, barely even a minority, the Irish, it has driven a great many of them into the ranks of the Royal Navy. And those people are, in many cases, used to being part of a secret society, used to be opposing the official order, and are very easily recruited. And then to say this is to say, yeah, there's something to Philip McDougall's thesis about the Irish component here. I don't think it's the whole thing, but I think it's an important part. The other important parts are what is going on in France. And the French Revolution has been smeared a lot of times, and it has generally got a very unpleasant reputation in the English-speaking world. But that was not the case in the 1790s. For example, William Blake was arrested and held by military, not even a military court, just a group of soldiers for lounging around the coast and voicing disrespectful comments about the French, supposedly something on the lines of, I hope they do come. That was very dangerous. That was enough to get him held, but Blake led some sort of charmed life. Maybe literally. I mean, like, he did talk to angels all day. I don't know. In his case, I'm not sure that it was strictly schizophrenia, okay? It's like there's schizophrenia and then there's weird. So the sympathy for France among the lower classes is really intense, just as intense as the hatred for France in the upper classes. The Irish compose not only a big population in sympathy with France. Remember, there's an Irish song from 1798. Oh, the French are on the sea, says the Shan Ban Vaught, the old gray woman. The French are on the sea, says the Shan Ban Vaught. The French are on the sea. They'll be here. I don't know. But anyway, it's like, yay, we're going to get free and all this. But this was very, very big in the English population as well. And it was even big in a population that after 1798 turned away from revolution, and that is the Protestants of Ireland. They, too, were very unhappy with their conditions under English rule, and they did see it as English rule. They were forced to tithe to the Church of Ireland, and the Church of Ireland is now pretty much defunct, but when I was staying in Ireland in Sandymount, South Dublin, there was this vast edifice, this vast church, which never had anybody in it. And I asked around what it was, and it turned out to be a Church of Ireland church that had been built for some incredibly wealthy landlord. And because his wife wanted a church of her own, which was a quaint little ambition, because this thing was like gigantic, like a Mormon tabernacle. And
but this is like basically an Anglican church, but for the Protestant landlords in Ireland.
Yeah, but they weren't Anglican. They were Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, okay.
And Presbyterians can be very fierce.
Yes, sometimes they still are.
Sometimes in ways that aren't so smart like they are now, but they were very smart and very fierce in that time. They saw especially what was going on in America, because that was largely a Protestant dissenter-led revolt against Britain. And they thought, okay, we can make common cause with the Irish. In fact, their leader, Wolfe Tone, who's still revered in Ireland, some of you may know the band The Wolfe Tones, which was kind of a heavy pun of the rock and roll days, like, you know, the what tones, the wolf tones. That's, yeah. You know, it was funny in its way. And they coalesced into a conspiratorial order. Some of them were resistant to making common cause with papists. And Wolf Tone said, "You're a bunch of idiots. We don't need you. We'll just go on without you." And they became a sort of ecumenical effort against the English crown. And Wolf Tone traveled to France and began negotiations with the French revolutionary authorities. And many of his agents, and again, I'm supporting MacDougall's thesis in a limited way here.
Yeah.
Many of his agents visited towns like Portsmouth, which were very near the Spithead anchorage that was the source of one of the major mutinies. So it may be that the combination of conspiratorial skills and the organizing tradition, plus the intellectual contribution of the Ulster Protestant elite, like Wolf Tone. He spoke French. He could fit easily into Parisian society. It may have had a role in this. I don't know how big it is, but they definitely had a role in what happened. The other thing to keep in mind is there are two big Royal Navy bases that are going to become the focus of this vast mutiny. One of them is the Spithead near Portsmouth. The other one, a very strange one, is the Nore, which I had not really known much about before I looked into this. The Nore is apparently just an anchorage in shallow water off the mouth of the Thames. If anybody knows anything about it after you hear this this episode, let me know, because I don't really know anything about it even now. But they anchored many ships close to each other in the Nore because, you know, remember this, the whole expanse of the North Sea was once land, pretty recently too, in the last big ice age. So the water's very shallow there. You can anchor there pretty safely. So the more radical part of the mutiny to come was in the ships of the Nore. And that was where you get some really remarkable statements of revolutionary intent. But we'll talk about that in the next episode.
Okay. And, you know, to your point about the role that Wolf Tone and his sort of conspiratorial kind of revolutionary organizers, whatever you would call them, the Irish, the United Irishmen, that they played in this. I mean, it, like, you first of all have to have the conditions to make their ability to persuade possible. You have to have these horrible conditions that that you've already described, that the sailors are going through, that the Irish are going through, who make up a lot of sailors, that they are already, and their attraction to, their obvious attraction to what was out there in the air from the French Revolution, the American Revolution, so that when Wolf Tone's agents come through, it would be a lot easier. Their message would, you know, resonate a lot more easily with the people who are going to mutiny, right? So it doesn't even have to be an either-or thing. So, yeah.
That's true. Yeah. And, there was definitely a component of that. At the very least, there was. In fact, I know it's ahistorical and it's kind of a dumb comparison, but I can't help thinking of Hunter Thompson trying to persuade the Hell's Angels to go along with the anti-war demonstrators. Although that's really unfair in multiple ways, but I can't help being reminded of it.
Yeah. Well, that was funny.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think at this point we can stop. So yeah, next episode will be the mutinies themselves. Thank you, John. This has been great. And thanks, Brendan. Thank you, everyone. And
thanks, everybody.
All right. Bye.
Okay, bye.